Audio Service.
Welcome to the National Radio Club's DX Audio Service for December 2008. This is issue number 285. If you'd like to write to us at the DX Audio Service, our address is 706 McKenzie Drive, Lima, Ohio, 45805-1835. Telephone number 360-382-1957. Email sales@nrcdxas.org. A subscription to the DX Audio Service for U.S.-Canadian members is $28. To Europe and elsewhere, it's $40. Tapes are sent by first-class mail, and you keep your cassettes. To subscribe or renew, make your check payable to the National Radio Club Incorporated and send them to me at the address that is mentioned, or simply log on to our website at www.nrcdxas.org and sign up using our PayPal credit card system. You can also sign up to EDXN and get your DX Audio Service on your computer or iPod player in stereo. A subscription to EDXN is only $15. Just point your browser to www.e-dxn.com and subscribe online with our PayPal credit card system, or contact Wayne Heinen at Post Office Box 473251, Aurora, Colorado 80047, 3251 if you want to pay by check. Well, we have a fully packed edition of the DX Audio Service for this holiday edition, so let's switch it right over to Bill Hale with a look at the AM switch.
Well, thanks, Fred, and welcome everyone to the December 2008 edition of AM Switch for the DX Audio Service. Jumping right into call letter changes that have occurred over the past month, 590 WRAG Carrollton, Alabama has switched to WREN. 890 WWOF Lithia Springs, Georgia has changed to WJTP. They have a pending construction permit coming from 1,000 on the dial, and also changing cities of license from Walhalla, South Carolina. 1020 WRHB Kendall, Florida has switched to WURN. 1020 WJEP Ocklockney, Georgia, their new call is WSBX. 1300 WJFK in Baltimore, Maryland has made the switch to a historic call, WJZ. That goes way back to the 30s. 1310 KRBI St. Peter, Minnesota, they're now known as KGLB. 1310 WABD Asbury Park, New Jersey, their new call is WBUD. 1340 KIST Santa Barbara, California has switched to KCLU. On 1400 WKXI Jackson, Mississippi, their new call is WJQS. 1490 KBKO Santa Barbara, California, they're now known as KIST, so they've taken up that call off 1340. And 1570 KSXT Loveland, Colorado, KPIO is their new call. 1580 WPGC Morningside, Maryland is switching to WHFS. Probably by the time you hear this, they will have made that change. Well, construction permits which have taken to the air over the past 30 days, WXME 780 in Monticello, Maine, their CP for 5,000 watts daytime, 60 watts at night, all non-directional, is now on. There had been some confusion as to WXME's status, as it was reported as heard on 780, but for a long time licensed on 710 with a CP going to 780 in FCC records. On 10/17/2008, the FCC finally listed WXME as being licensed on 780. 1050 KMTA Miles City, Montana is now on the air with 10,000 watts during the day, 136 watts at night, non-directional. 1120 KEOR Catoosa, Oklahoma, their construction permit for 2,000 watts daytime only, directional, is now on. Their pattern favors the south-southwest. They are formerly 1110 in Atoka. 1130 WACQ Carville, Alabama, their CP for daytime only, 25,000 watts, and critical hours, 1,000 watts, is now on, all non-directional. They've increased the day power and added that CH designation. 1230 KLAV Las Vegas, Nevada, their CP for 1,000 watts day and night, non-directional, is now on, moving to a new tower site. KLAV had been operating with 500 watts from a long wire antenna since February. 1230 KBCQ Roswell, New Mexico, a CP is now on for 620 watts days and 1,000 watts at night. 1320 WBOB Jacksonville, Florida, Their CP is U2, that's daytime non-directional, nighttime directional, 50,000 watts days, 5,000 watts night. And I was alerted to that change by a report from Finland that they had received them. That's correct. On 1340, now KCLU in Santa Barbara, California, their construction permit for 650 watts day and night is now on the air. 1410 WRMN, Elgin, Illinois, their CP for 1,000 watts daytime, 1,300 watts at night is now on, directional nights only. 1490 KWAC in Bakersfield, California, their CP for 640 watts day and night is now on. 1490 KEYG Grand Coulee, Washington, their CP for 1,000 watts daytime, 960 watts is on. 1530 KVOG Agana, Guam, their new station is on with 250 watts day and night, all non-directional. Some actions taken this past month. 820 WCPT, Willow Springs, Illinois. CP has been granted for 5,000 watts daytime, 1,500 watts at night, directional night only. That's U2. The new six-tower array will be two rows of three towers aligned northeast to southwest near Ridgewood, Illinois, and direct the signal in a line directly away from Fort Worth. With this action by the FCC, WCPT voluntarily turned in their CP for 3,200 watts daytime only. 910 KTRO Vancouver, Washington, a CP has been granted for 2,600 watts days, 4,300 watts nights, two patterns, that's U4, moving from a four-tower array to a new three-tower site. 930 WSFZ Jackson, Mississippi, a CP has been granted for U2, 3,800 watts days, 3,100 nighttime watts, as they move to the transmitter site of WOAD 1300 and add two towers to that array. Because the WOAD single tower is substantially taller than those at the current site, WSFZ is forced to decrease their power to the new levels to cover the same area. 1050 KTCT, San Mateo, California, a special temporary authority, hereafter known as an STA, has been granted to operate during daylight hours with 12,500 watts non-directional for 180 days from the date of the grant, which was October 16th. The purpose of this change is to take field measurements. This complements the current STA in force since 2005. The owner noted that the STA was necessary to enable KTCT, and I quote directly from the application, to overcome interference being caused by an unauthorized operation of co-channel station KXED in Mexicali, Baja California. I may add here that the correct call is XED, not KXED, but we will proceed. And once again, we are quoting from the application. Specifically, KTCT was authorized to continue operating with its daytime facilities during nighttime hours in order to overcome interference from KXED. The interference situation with respect to the co-channel Mexican station has not changed, and thus the conditions which led the commission to grant the initial STA. End of quote. This action means KTCT is now operating daytime 12,500 watts non-directional, nighttime directional 10,000 watts. 1060 WILB Canton, Ohio, CP has been granted for 15,000 watts directional daytime only. The new daytime pattern, kind of shaped like a lima bean, turns from favoring the southwest to due west. WOAP 1080 Waverly, Michigan, a CP mod has been granted for 50,000 watts daytime, 4,500 watts at night, U4, adding nighttime operation to the current construction permit. This also is a change in city license from Owasso. I'll have another note on this 1080 situation in Michigan at the end of AM switch. Okay, let's get into some easy stuff now. 1190 WSDE, Cobleskill, New York, CP has been granted for non-directional, 1,000 watts daytime, 20 watts at night, adding that night service. 1190 WAGE, Leesburg, Virginia, a CP has been granted to move here from 1200 with 50,000 watts daytime, 1,300 watts at night, two patterns, or U4. As near as I can figure out from assorted documents, all of which come to different conclusions, WAGE moves to 1190 and WBIS 1190 goes off, surrendering its license. WAGE will build three new towers at its current site for daytime operation and utilize the current WBIS 4 tower site for nighttime operation. 1500 WFED Washington, D.C. has been granted an STA, 12,500 watts day and night, as the transmitter site undergoes an RF system refurbishing project, which includes a new phaser, transmission lines, etc. The project is slated to be finished on or about 1 December. So if you heard some strange things on 1500 where you normally don't hear that, that probably was WFED tweaking in there. 1570 WECU in Winterville, North Carolina, CP has been granted for 8,000 watts daytime, 200 watts at night, all non-directional. And 1590 WCSL, Cherryville, North Carolina, CP has been granted for 10,000 watts daytime, 30 watts at night, and I note at very last minute here, it is now on the air. One new station has been granted, 1370 in Heflin, Alabama. They'll have 250 watts day and night, nighttime directional only. Well, some more Canadian AM to FM migrations. A 900 CKDH in Amherst, Nova Scotia. They've applied to move to 107.1 with 40 kilowatts. And 1340 CKDR Revelstoke, BC has applied to move to 106.1 with 800 watts. 600 CKPD in Vancouver, British Columbia is now off, moving to 100.5 megahertz as CKPK the peak. So another legendary Canadian AM station is gone. Some other notes from here and there reported to have returned to the airwaves. KOTC 830 Kennett, Missouri with classic hits, and their parallel or simulcasting with KXOQ 104.3, the Quake. However, these stations have been reported to have their plate voltage in the off position. WJEP 1020, Occlokne, Florida. KNUV 1190, Tolleson, Arizona. KVWG 1280, Pearsall, Texas. KNOX 1310, Grand Forks, North Dakota. KGLD 1330, Tyler, Texas. KACT 1360, Andrews, Texas. KWWJ 1360, Baytown, Texas. WVOT 1420 Wilson, North Carolina. WSYA 1490 Anniston, Alabama. KHLT 1520 Hallettsville, Texas. WVZN 1580 Columbia, Pennsylvania. KQLO 1590 Sun Valley, Nevada. And WLUZ 1600 Bayamon, Puerto Rico. I guess the economy is really taking its toll in the radio industry. Some fines to report this month, adding dollars to the FCC coffers. KBRN 1500 Bernie, Texas has been fined $20,000, reduced from the initial $25,000, for multiple infractions, including but not limited to, and we quote, willful and repeated violations involving their failure to maintain a main studio in its community of license, failure to install and maintain an operational emergency alert system equipment, and failure to make the station's public inspection file available, end of quote. WSDE 1190 Cobleskill, New York has been fined $12,800, reduced from an initial $16,000 for, we quote, willfully and repeatedly failing to maintain operational emergency alert system equipment, failing to sign off at local sunset time, failing to maintain daytime operating power at more than 90% of the authorized power, and failing to maintain a complete public inspection file, end of quote. NWLAA 1600 Ocoee, Florida has been fined $16,000 for, quote, willful and repeated violations for not maintaining an operational emergency alert system and failure to maintain public inspection files, end of quote. Well, a little while ago, we mentioned the new station going on, a 1080 in Michigan. Well, those of you in the upper Midwest and the East might say, well, wait a minute, what about WTIC? They throw a pretty potent signal out west. Thought we'd throw this in. The Federal Communications Commission has modified the license of legacy station WTIC 1080, Hartford, Connecticut, over objections from its owner, CBS, in order to allow WOAP Owosso, Michigan, to operate at night. Currently licensed as a daytimer with 1,000 watts, WOAP has a CP to increase power to 50,000 watts daytime directional and move to Waverly. It has asked permission also to operate at night with 4.5 kilowatts directional. As we noted before, that has been granted. The commission staff says this action will allow the first full-time local broadcast service for residents of Waverly, Michigan. In contention here was how this change would affect WTIC during the hour right after its local sunset. WTIC enjoys a grandfathered permission to operate with its daytime non-directional facilities an extra 45 to 75 minutes, as that's the difference between local sunset in Hartford and co-channel and fellow 50-kilowatt Class A KRLD in Dallas. However, WTIC's license was not specific as to the type of interference protection that applies to that extended period. Under the rules, during daytime hours, AM station protection is based on ground wave signal propagation, while at night it's based on sky wave. Now the FCC has ruled that only the ground wave signal of WTIC's extended daytime operation is protected, and it will permit predicted interference to WTIC's sky wave from WOAP during that evening window. Explaining its ruling, the FCC said co-channel stations WKJK in Louisville and WWNL in Pittsburgh, among others, are predicted to cause interference within the protected contour of the extended WTIC daytime operation if the nighttime protection requirements are applied. That means there is now marginal, if any, WTIC skywave service during the time of day in question, and that the situation will not be made worse by allowing WOAP to air at night. In making the decision, the commission rejected several arguments. CBS felt the change would be detrimental to the public interest. It said listeners in that area of Michigan are already well served at night. Also, it said WOAP's proposed nighttime 0.025 millivolt per meter, 10% interfering contour, overlaps a portion of WTIC's extended daytime operation that contains more than 16 million people. Thus, this CBS suggested would harm its ability to provide important emergency messages, as only one of 37 primary entry point stations in the country. But the FCC said WTIC will continue to receive protection of its ground wave signal, so its role as a PEP station will be unaffected. CBS also thought the commission should not, by precedent, consider interference from other stations in determining whether to allow new interference from a proposed facility. The commission agreed, but said its past actions indicate that it had never intended to protect fully WTIC's skywave signal during that period. And CBS said WTIC has operated with its current licensed facility for more than 65 years, and that the secondary service area has been protected, including skyway protection, during extended daytime operation since 1941. But WOAP's owner told the FCC that WTIC has never been entitled to skywave protection during this window of time, that the ruling would allow it to implement its first local radio service to Waverly, that the change will not interfere with WTIC's operations in Connecticut, and that CBS could have challenged the change earlier and failed to do so, even though it was clear that CBS knew about the issues because the station's engineers have had conversations concerning these issues. CBS had also argued against allowing WOAP to relocate from Owosso to Waverly at all, saying this would deprive Owosso of its only local AM service, and that Waverly isn't a community but part of a Lansing urbanized area. The FCC ruled in a footnote that neither of these facetious arguments warrants further consideration. We thank Radio World Online for that report. Well, my thanks go out to Sean Axelrod, Bill Dvorak, Wayne Heinen, Dean McIntyre, Dave Schmidt, Jerry Starr, Hakan Sunman, and Frank Welch for reports this month. Well, that's AM Switch for December 2008. We wish you all a very happy holiday season and the best of DX in 2009.
Hey, Mama, look! There's Santa Claus!
Merry Christmas, everybody! Ho, 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 ho!
Gee, it's really him!
Hiya, Santa Claus!
Well, thank you, Bill, and happy holidays, everyone. John's taking a well-deserved break this month while he works to assemble the January travelogue. And what an honor it is to use his time for an expanded column. As we look back on what appears to be an anniversary of sort for this reporter, 10 years of great fun and carrying on the Bandscan column, that was so well presented in the early years by our friend Jim Snowbarger. So today we're going to turn back the clock to replay a few of our favorite recordings. The problem, of course, is that in 10 years of reporting, we have more than 1,500 minutes of material from which to choose, and only about 20 minutes in which to do this. So forgive our arbitrary choices and see how many of these broadcasts you might remember. We began back in the 1990s doing what many of you have done, submitting captures on tape, in this case for Jim's column. And when he decided to retire in 1998, Fred and John suggested that we start a regular column. Since that time, we've been honored to be part of a terrific team of editors and contributors, moving our DXAS technology forward from early recordings on cassettes through the evolution of digital recording and editing to the mini disc, the iPod, and the computer age. In fact, about the only thing that hasn't changed in this past decade is the radios we use. And of course, the other thing that hasn't changed is your enthusiasm and support for the DX Audio service. In the past 10 years, we've talked with transmitter engineers and communications attorneys, historians and DXers, talk show hosts, and just plain folks. We've brought you band scans of the clear channels from almost every part of the country. We've talked about reception ideas and noise hunting, how the networks operated, how radio sounded in an earlier time, how radio towers work, and what happened when they sometimes fell down. During the 6 years we lived in western Colorado, we spent a lot of time in the Utah desert behind our 2,000 and 3,000-foot beverage antennas, and you heard a lot about how beverage antennas work. You'll remember how easily we were able to switch back and forth between signals from east and west. But the most convincing demos of that antenna were the long-distance catches. You may remember the day we heard Boston and New York City midday. And then, one crystal-clear night in October 2004, we did far better than expected. We reported on that evening on the November 2004 band scan. Next, the distance record for the night, a bit over 2,000 airline miles.
We'll take a quick timeout. Come right back. David Essel is my guest. His book, Slow Down, the fastest way to get everything you want. We'll be right back.
The Jordan Rich Show. So just listen. Call and contribute. 617-254-1030. WBZ News Radio 1030. Every day. Homeowners need to refinance, but fast credit problems, slow payments, a bankruptcy or foreclosure are in the way. Catch up on payments. Combine your first and second mortgage. Take care of those bills. Call Optimal Mortgage and take advantage of our Fresh Start program with a brand new fixed rate of 5%. It's virtually half.
At the end of that same evening, we dialed up to 1710, looking for what would have been an impossible to capture 1 watt signal from almost 1500 miles to the east. Several DXers had reported a barely legible, mysterious Morse code signal. Well, we thought just for grins we'd apply the power of the beverage as a signal seeker, and by golly, there it was. And finally, the reception that helped Fred Volbe get over his flu this weekend. Here's what we heard in the desert in eastern Utah at 7:20 p.m. Mountain Daylight Time, Sunday, October 10th. One of our favorite interviews was the colorful Augie Prestholt. Remember him, longtime broadcast professional engineer who had designed and installed hundreds of high-power radio stations during his half-century of broadcast engineering. We had traveled to his home in Florida, stopping to see John Bowker on the way. Augie provided us with a lot of information, but his reminiscences of the human side of his adventure is what always stuck with me. Here's one short example taken from the July 2000 band scan.
I was down in L.A. one time, and, I guess that's when I've been out to measure K-Big.
It was a daytimer, correct, on 740?
Yeah, on Catalina Island. I wanted to get out and make some measurements on this K-Big. So I flew out there on a DC-3. My guide met me at the motel I was staying. He was going to take me up to where I wanted to go on the mountain in the background. He was carrying a sidearm in his Jeep and a lever-action carbine. Well armed. There are buffalo and boar running wild on that pasture out there. And he was going to protect me. If he had to shoot one down, he was going to shoot him.
They weren't on the mountain. You were just up there taking
They were on the mountain.
Oh, they were on the mountain with an AM stick.
With an AM. Coming back, I flew back to Long Beach, the DC-3, and this is a very interesting takeoff. It's on top of the mountain, and the runway is not very long. It's very short in both ends, as a matter of fact.
But the middle's okay.
The middle's all right. So he revs the damn thing up with the tail almost hanging over fresh air. Full throttle, and they're shaking like, releases the brakes, go charging down the runway, full throttle, comes to the end of the runway, and dives. We were, the runway is about 1,500 feet, and he went down about 500 feet to get airspeed and wheeled back.
Hey, did you know that was going to happen?
I don't think I did, but I'll tell you, it's an attention getter. You're looking out the window, and, you know, the landing field's up there. Oh.
Do you remember the time we interviewed WCCO engineer Jerry Miller? Jerry was an alternative FCC inspector, and he gave advice to AM stations on how to follow the rules, and to DXers on what to do if they notice clear violations of the nighttime power down rules.
As the sun goes down, of course, sky wave starts to come in, and it's imperative to reduce your power, because otherwise your neglect is going to be somebody else's crisis, and there's where you're going to get a fine if you're a broadcaster. Why should your inability to operate according to the license specification cause somebody else in another market the inability to reach their legal audience during that time? It's absolutely critical.
So if I hear this happening, and I know it hasn't switched because I'm a DXer of some experience and I know what the signal should do, and I can tell that nothing happened, and I call the station and they say, oh, the computer must have screwed up, they're still liable.
That's correct, and the nicest thing you could do at that point, provided they've given the right call letters and you know who they are, is to not only call them, but I really, really recommend that you would send a letter to them and state the time and the date that this happened. And if they fail to give you proper call letters, then at least if you know what state it is in, send it to the state association, and the state association can give them a heads up. If you refer to the FCC rule and regulation and you send it to the state association or the broadcasters, I think that action will be immediately taken. If you wanted to step it up to another level, you can always carbon copy a higher authority.
And that is the FCC.
Well, that's right. And I think the one thing, of course, is establishing your own credibility, knowing the exact rule, the exact regulation, and how it addresses the problem, and stated on paper with carbon copies to the right source. And I always recommend going to the station first, then the broadcast association.
And would it be useful to send a cassette, a recording, that clearly shows that there was no idea at the top of the hour?
Absolutely. That's documentation, and documentation would lend you credibility.
Longtime listeners to this band scan may recall the August 1999 column that included an attempt by WOR Radio to bounce a signal off Mars. The year of the broadcast was 1939, and Mars was very much on people's minds ever since the famous War of the Worlds broadcast had happened just a few months earlier.
The planet Mars, ironically enough, made one of its periodic approaches to the Earth, coming as near our planet as it ever does. Millions saw the pink star hanging low in the east, and WOR's Special Features Division tried a unique experiment. No one knows whether it is possible to send a radio signal through the dense atmospheric layers surrounding the Earth. WOR engineers tried to do it and ambitiously set about preparing an attempt to transmit those signals directly to Mars, hoping they would strike that planet and bouncing off return again to Earth. The attempt was broadcast to listeners throughout the country, and many of them will remember the tense scene at the transmitter when the WOR announcer told them all was ready.
Now, engineer Charles Singer will press a key, and the dots and dashes that you will hear will be picked up as they are transmitted from a special antenna beamed at Mars. All right, here we go. Signals are on their way, and if they have penetrated through the Kennelly Heaviside layer, a magnetic layer some 50 miles to 100 miles above the Earth, it is reasonable to believe that they will continue on through space and strike Mars. So let's pause now and wait, if you'll be patient, and see if we hear the signal return. Well, it should be here. Well, for the purposes of our experiment, the signal failed to return, and so we're going to conclude this broadcast in which we have attempted to send the signal to Mars and back to Earth.
He dumped out of that in a hurry, didn't he?
This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.
WOR, Newark.
In January 2002, we visited John McKinney, former engineering director of the famous FCC Grand Island, Nebraska monitoring station. John's remarks were colorful and informative, based on his 60 years in the business. In this short excerpt, we talked about what the monitoring stations were doing to aid the war effort, and about the antenna tools used for monitoring.
In 1939, when the war began in Europe, we became concerned about radio traffic and so forth, and spies and this sort of thing. They established what was called the NDO, the National Defense Operation. But as soon as war was declared, they changed it over to the Radio Intelligence Division, RID. Well, they ended up with around 13 primary monitoring stations, including one in Honolulu, near Honolulu, and one in Alaska. The old Hadcock, their former...
Can you explain for the non-technical people what an Adcock is?
The first Hadcock they used during World War II was a small house on stilts that you reach the inside of the house by going up a ladder underneath the center of the house and through a trap door. And in there you had a bench about the size of a desk that you sat before on a stool. And coming down into that direct center of that desk, there was a wheel that rotated a pipe that went on up through the peak of the roof of this little shack that you have. There was a boom extending, maybe 12 or 15 feet. We had no power out there because to put any lines, any wires out there whatsoever, we felt would distort our bearings. It was a direction finder. That's what it was. Adcock direction finder, right. We had two Adcocks. Right?
What else did you have back there?
There were five beverage antennas that were put in. These were put in. They're some of the earliest ones that were put in because they were interested in broadcast and they wanted the low-frequency wave antenna for that purpose. And the longest one we had was 1,800 feet long, and you wouldn't even recognize it because it ran down over the barbed wire fence. Those fence posts were higher than normal fence posts. They were about 12 foot high. There was another beverage going out through the backfield that we called the Atlanta one. It was kind of focused on Atlanta, Georgia. And there was another one that was due east, 90 degrees. It was great, if you wanted to get Washington, D.C. or Denver. Or San Francisco, right? East and west. And there was another that was pointed at Chicago, somewhere around 70 degrees. There was another one that was, probably pointed more at Minneapolis, I would say. I can't remember, in that general area.
Northeast, slightly.
Most of my work with the commission, we were not really interested too much in what the broadcasters were doing. We did it incidentally. I mean, we were more interested in what Russia was doing or what Germany was doing, depending on what time period we're talking at. You know what I mean? So we were spending more time with shortwave
right.
than we were on the others. But
the beverages were probably your workhorses, weren't they?
The beverages for our medium wave band were our workhorses, right.
On the September 2002 band scan, we interviewed Gary Wilson about the role of PPAC, a formal organization of high-power stations that coordinates emergency alerting announcements from the White House and automatically distributes them around the country. It was all controlled by a mysterious classified box, about which we were given little detail, except to learn of how that box could misfire. Do you remember back then the mistaken alert that took over a good number of the country's stations for almost an hour one Friday afternoon?
The box theoretically should only be able to be activated by the president or someone in his office. Okay.
I met a couple of the guys who carry the football, I think they call it, those military communications guys.
Yeah.
The bag. Our program's in his bag. He can activate it.
And when he pushes a button or whatever he does, that should automatically switch all of the stations participating to this source, and everybody's getting the feed from wherever the president is.
Correct.
At the same time.
That's how it's supposed to work.
I like the way you said that's how it's supposed to work, because I want to get into some stories about whether it's rolled out the way it should have.
There was a station who will remain nameless who, as we all want to do, is make sure the system works and test it well. The individual at the station had all of his equipment taken out of the loop, so there's no way this signal could go on the air, and he wanted an actual send me a presidential message like the president's going to go. Well, FEMA's a government agency, and they have great programs and great training and great procedures.
I'm waiting for the but.
But, so the way the story goes is, they were getting ready to test, so they go to the page on the computer screen where this individual station is and select, yes, go to this station, and then put a little checkbox next to the rest of them saying, don't send to this station. Well, that's one page. Unfortunately, there were two more pages after that station that somebody forgot to look at and check, no, don't send a signal to here. So when the signal went up to this one station, it also connected to all these other stations
on pages two and three.
On pages two and three.
Oh, my.
And this, of course, was a Friday afternoon.
Dead air.
Well, apparently we had some dead air and a lot of testing. One, two, three. Can you guys hear me? And it, not only did it capture the big stations, of course, the system worked the way it's supposed to. The big stations then capture the little stations, and it has the trickle-down effect. So all of the state of Florida, apparently all of, most of Ohio, and it went down the line. The system does work.
When was this? Do you remember?
It's right after we got the new systems in.
I'll bet our listeners remember. I'm sure a lot of them.
I'm sure, because it's been discussed a lot. You see a lot of it.
My understanding is that the equipment at the transmitter is such that you have to go out to the transmitter and manually disconnect it in order to stop the
The
takeover.
That's now changed.
Yeah. And so that, and a lot of transmitters didn't have someone manning the transmitter sites.
And there was one facility where the engineer was more than 45 minutes away.
The longest in-depth interview we did was with WLW's Paul Jellison at Christmas 2002 and reported during our 2003 band scans. Paul recalls Y2K and what WLW did for the last broadcast of the 20th and the first broadcast of the 21st century.
Most of us in the business were in front of our computers on December 31st, 1999, as we approached Y2K. You were out here engaging in a labor of love. Tell us about that.
Well, we had to do Y2K duty because of all the issues involved. And I had people downtown covering the digital audio stuff and all that. And being the boss, I thought, well, okay, I live next door, so why not make it easy on myself? What I did, I got over here, I don't know, 9:30, you know, bored. You know, it's New Year's Eve and I'm not out, so, okay, what can I get into? I thought, well, you know what, I'm sort of jokingly said I'm going to do this, so I decided to fire up the old Western Electric, which is the original 50 kilowatt transmitter that WLW operated from. 1928 is the year it was installed. It is a 1927 model. Fiddled around with it a little bit, brought it up, and it came right up, and we operated till after midnight. And they actually announced, you know, made a couple announcements on the air. And I sent out an email to just a few friends had people call me the next year. You're going to do that next year? And I'm like, well, no, I have a life. I actually plan on going out.
But, you know, if you think about the romance of it and the symbolism, what you did, you were approaching the new millennium, and here you fire up a transmitter that was built 70 years earlier. And it came right up online. It sounded pretty good.
Yes, it did. It sounded good. And, you know, the thing is I sat there a little bit and I thought about the audio that passed through this transmitter all during those years. You know, you've got literally, World War II, Korean, Vietnam. I mean, this transmitter was in mainline service until early to mid 70s. So this thing saw a lot of man on the moon. I mean, everything. It was pretty impressive. Once I sit back and start thinking about that, I'm like, wow, that's, you know.
The most requested band scan replay may have been our interview at WSM in Nashville, reported in the October 1999 column. Loyal listeners remember that in spite of our attempt at eloquence in describing that heritage transmitter building, it was the actual sounds we heard that brought it home.
Now we're in the, probably going to the generator room would be my
guess.
Yeah,
this used to be, there used to be a vat over there, and part of the circulation system was there. And in this room, which is now the generator room, there was the top wasn't on here, there was an open, this is open to the top, and this was a heat exchanger room in here where they circulated the closed loop water and
that was in
stored
here, okay.
Water.
This looks like about a 200 kilowatt generator?
Actually, it's about 175. That came in here in 1960, and it runs like a sewing machine.
I'll bet it does. I'll bet it cranks over just like that. He said, backing toward the door.
I'll write it for you. You want me to?
Sure. All right, folks, this is what happens. I warned you.
After clearing our ears for a while, we journeyed out to the backyard, where we saw how WSM handled the water needed to cool the transmitter.
This looks like a garage, but it's not. But it sits on top of a 20,000-gallon concrete-encased water tank. They pumped water up from the Harpeth River, and this is where they stored their water. So they had people that didn't do anything but keep this system working, and there's a whole series of pumps that were out back that they used to keep this thing working. But it's really amazing.
This now
that manhole cover there puts you down into that tank.
Cistern, huh?
Yeah, which is there's a ladder that goes down. That thing is enclosed in concrete, and it's full of water.
Soundscapes from WSM that speak for themselves. Back in 1999, when AM iBach was still on the drawing boards, we visited with leading technologists who provided a fairly realistic picture of what would be expected. What no one talked about at the time was the problem from the iBach hash that has become so prevalent. Remember, back then, there was no iBach on the air, only on the drawing boards. But even then, they had a sense of the fact that AM iBach, especially at night, might not work. The cure-all at that time was the so-called blend, where the digital receiver was supposed to smoothly fall back on the monaural analog signal when digital got in trouble. Well, as we know, that blend solution between digital and analog has proved to be impractical, and that's because of the timing issues between the analog and digital signals. But in the days before iBach was actually tested, blend was the supposed cure-all. Here, for example, is leading broadcast engineer Ted Schober.
Let's take the guy who's been listening for years and years and years to the Clear Channel AM stations at night. He's used to that romantic sound of the long, lazy AM skywave fade. What's going to happen out there? He's going to either have a signal or he's not.
That's right. It's going to be an on or off situation, and that's going to be based upon two components. One will be the amount of signal which is actually received in its multipath distortion, and the second will also be how much interference that it receives in that part of the service area. So if there's a first adjacent station that is operating near the reception point, you may find that you'll have a blend, even though moving, 5 miles further away from that other first adjacent station may remove all of that that limitation.
Blend isn't so bad, but we're also dealing with something that's not unlike the FM capture effect, where you have an either-or situation. What happens there?
There's a process in any receiver which is essentially blanketing interference, where the front end of the radio cannot receive the desired signal because there's an adjacent signal which blocks it. Blocking interference, there's nothing that I can think of that fixes the problem without being expensive.
What we know today as Ubiquiti was once known as USA Digital Radio, or USADR. Here's their proponent, Glenn Walden. I asked him what would happen to Skywave, and his answer was less than encouraging.
USADR's goal in developing an iBach system is to develop a system that's intended primarily for ground wave service area. We have not done much testing with the system on Skywave, although we have gone out and listened to it back in 1995 on Skywave. We have not focused on that. Our focus is on ground wave. Again, We're not doing any SkyWave testing right now, or have done none, and have not exercised the system in our simulations for that. However, during the field testing, we'll make some effort to take a look at what happens in SkyWave performance.
And noted consultant Bob Culver was perhaps the most practical in viewing the problems. Remember, this was back in 1999, long before IBOC hit the airwaves.
There won't be any good feedback for the listener. With his ears as to whether or not the signal is going to be reliable until he starts to listen to it and starts to hear dropouts in audio. And there's no way to tune or adjust the receiver or adjust the tuning or anything to compensate for any interference. Like at night in SkyWave, when you get narrow banding or a sideband disappears, the audio shifts and you can hear that and you can compensate for it. And with your ear and your hearing, your ear-brain interface, you can tolerate a bunch of noise and a bunch of interference. But with
it's
digital,
kind of the fun of the capture, you know.
Yeah, well, it is, because
pulling it out of the noise.
Yeah, right. You can, well, even in a crowd, if you're standing in a crowd, you can try to focus in on somebody and actually pick out a conversation in the crowd if you work at it. But in the crowd of the noise of the spectrum in analog, you can pull it out. And if you're really dedicated, you can go ahead and listen to a noisy signal. But with digital, if it's interfered with enough that the digital quits, it's just not there. And you can't get around that. And you can't really pull the information out of a chopped up when the audio, therefore, like that, when the audio drops out every once in a while, you can't pull any information out of an audio stream like that. Where you can, if the audio is more or less continuous, but occasionally distorted a little bit by noise. So it's going to be a whole new learning experience.
Well, that is a very brief look back at 10 years of broadcasting the Bandscan column, and we thank Fred again for his patience. In months to come, we're embarking on a rather ambitious project to chronicle the development of clear channel stations by looking at each frequency once assigned to clear channel service, what the stations were doing, how they grew, changed their call letters and facilities, and yes, sometimes their frequencies. We'll continue to provide the occasional technical tips column on how to improve reception, and we'll keep looking for interviews with interesting folks who helped build the radio business. Lots of work ahead, but it's also a lot of fun and most rewarding. Perhaps the best part of all is that we have the opportunity to work with such a wonderful bunch of editors and contributors. So hats off to Fred and the gang, and hats off to you for being such great listeners. And here's to another 10 years, God willing. Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, and good listening, DXers.
KQDJ, Jamestown. Normally at this time we would have our church service from Trinity Lutheran Church. However, we are having some technical difficulties in receiving anything from the church. So in the meantime, we'll continue with regular programming from KQDJ in Jamestown.
At this time, please turn over your tape to side 2.